Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to today's Football Times from These Football Times, our weekly dip into contemporary football. International break this week, never a particularly enjoyable thing for those of us at These Football Times mostly. We keep a cursory eye on these things. We like our major international finals, but qualifiers have become largely, uncompetitive in many respects. But we can't do an international break without acknowledging what's going on. And tonight, our guests, we have the returning Rob Fletcher. We didn't scare him off last week enough for him to run for the hills. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, Stephen. More than happy to be back.
It's going to be a good one again after your triumphant debut last week. So yes, thank you for returning, Rob. And also joining us this week for another debutante, the wonderful Alex Ireland, author of the wonderful book Pretty Polly, which delves into the history of football kits. Welcome, Alex, and looking forward to your debut.
Yeah, I hope I do better than Brandon Williams. As a United fan, I got nightmares about that.
Oh, I'm sure it won't come to such a problematic start, I'm sure. Alex, but welcome, thank you so much. We'll just dive straight into it. I'm going to go to Rob first. Rob's bringing us his thoughts on Gareth Southgate's England, a 1-1 draw against Ukraine yesterday. They're getting the job done, Rob, but they're not exactly the most scintillating and exciting entity.
No, it's not, and I think that in your sort of introduction, you alluded to the uncompetitive nature of some of these qualifications that we've got at the moment. And I think England are symptomatic of that. To be fair to Gareth Southgate, I think he's doing brilliantly well to build a machine that gets through these games, which used to be quite difficult and challenging for some other England managers. You don't have to look too far back to find times when we probably really weren't at our best and we struggled over the line. And then that kind of filtered into tournaments. So on that note, I think Southgate's doing a good job. He's done a great job in tournaments. I can't deny that. He's done a great job in tournaments and probably better than any for a generation, really. But my issue with it is, and it's not really just from the draw against Ukraine, but I think it's a kind of a wider issue that a lot of people have with Southgate. And it's around team selection and style of play and the way that we're actually trying to build an exciting team. And we've got some really good young attacking players. And maybe Southgate's not utilising them as well as he could do, especially in some of the qualifiers, because we've seen in some of the finals games, his substitutions are a little bit off. They're either too late. They're not made at all. He doesn't quite know really how to utilise all of those attacking forces that he's got in his team. So really, it's kind of thinking about some of these qualifiers as maybe a breeding ground for this attacking style of football, or utilising like you like James Maddison, Phil Foden, you've got Jude Bellingham, Saka, Kane. I mean, we've got an embarrassment of riches going forwards, but then you see someone like Harry Maguire and Jordan Henderson back on the team sheet. And although they've been real stalwarts for Southgate, they're probably not going to lead us forward into multiple tournaments anymore. And I suppose, is it time to sort of put those players to pasture and start moving on to some of the younger players who'll carry us into the Euros and then further into more World Cups? We don't really want to become another Belgium who've got a golden generation that maybe doesn't do as well as it could have done, really.
Fair points there. I mean, Alex, Rob comes up with some very, very good points there. I mean, I suppose in a way, dispensing with the likes of Maguire and Henderson, who have served him well, the Maguire situation particularly bizarre considering he doesn't get a game at club level. But is there as kind of like his nation's kind of like cornerstone, basically. I suppose in many respects, it depends what Gareth Southgate's own long-term, his long-term intentions are. If he's thinking at the back of his mind, maybe be walking away at the end of the Euro 2024. It's that short-term kind of like, there's my finish line. I'll do whatever I need to get over the line. It does come to all managers in that respect. You know, I can look at Alex. So sorry to use Alex Ferguson as an example here, but you know, I think when you look at Alex Ferguson, you know, when he got to that kind of final straight, he understandably stops looking beyond what you feel to be your finish line.
I'm not sure about that with the Fergie comparison, but I think we could have a whole episode on that. But I think you're right in terms of England. He's a very cautious manager, isn't he? Like Rob, I really like what he's done in terms of the team, how they're represented. Clearly, there's a much better environment. The players feel really comfortable. There is definitely a team unit. But with that kind of caution, it comes into his play. He likes to control player games. He really doesn't like the unpredictability of it becoming open. And this you now see in his team selection that, as he suggested, these players like Maguire and Henderson, who've served him really well, he's not kind of ready to move them on. I think it's really kind of inexcusable in both parts, because as a United fan, I am very fond of Maguire. You know, he is a character, you know, he clearly is sort of a big character, somebody who's really passionate. He's very committed, but the game really seems to have left him behind. You know, his lack of pace is just absolutely critical. It just stands out an absolute mile. I think when you've got these young alternatives, say particularly Tomori, you know, the idea that you've got a year to bed them in, I don't see why that isn't being done or hasn't been done earlier. I think there are question marks against some of the other candidates. You know, when you think of, you know, who else could you pick? There's Eric Dyer, who probably isn't quite right there. People like Gaye, Colwell, you know, he's not really experienced at the Champions League level. Colwell is, again, very inexperienced. Dunk has been excellent in the Premier League, but, you know, again, has he been onto that next level? So I think it's just, yeah, this caution, but certainly he does seem a man out of time, Maguire. And then Henderson really seems even more inexplicable. You think that the wealth of talent that we've got in centre midfield, you know, likes of Rice and Mount and Bellingham and so on, you know, this is a player who wasn't a Premier League regular, he's now in the Saudi League. There are definitely players who can evolve and take over for him. And in particular, I think you run the risk of kind of dumbing down or reducing the impact of Bellingham. You know, he was not quite a peripheral figure, but when we've seen him absolutely explode as a number 10 in these early weeks of the season, you know, he is a player who needs to be absolutely the cornerstone of your team and be building around him, and to be sort of dragging Henderson around. Yeah, it just feels like that they've had their day, and it's kind of loyalty and this lack of ambition or safety first that's keeping him in there.
I mean, Rob, it's kind of like a bizarre two-handed coin in that respect. You know, to be so cautious. You know, I get that kind of loyalty to players. You know, a lot of England managers have done that over the years to, you know, their own detriment as well as their own success or comparative success. Where do you stand on Southgate's future as part of this? I always look for the clues between the lines in that respect. And, you know, Alex is very correct there in pointing out, you know, just how many heir apparents are there to a Maguire, for instance. But, you know, if a manager's not kind of plotting ahead, then, you know, surely it intimates that the landscape's going to change in the relative shorter term.
Yeah, it does seem that way. And I think Southgate himself is an intelligent man. He knows that he's not going to be in this job forever unless he wins a tournament, for me. So if he was to go to Euro 2024 and win a tournament, then I think he's got, you know, a pretty good argument that he should carry on based on his previous record. I think it's interesting in that sense that throughout his time as England manager, he's played mostly the right people at the right time for what he wants to play, despite what fans might think of that. Like when we were playing Declan Rice and Calvin Phillips in a 20-yard circle inside, you know, our own half and really being structurally sound. I think, you know, that's fine. And if he's a cautious manager, But what I think the problem he's got is that he hasn't shown that he can move it forward to actually get them over the line and win the tournament. It's all about, I mean, we've been here before, haven't we, with, you know, the 99 to 2008 team or whatever that had all the talent but didn't quite do it. I think these players are a bit different. They're a bit more unified. And for me, Southgate should have gone after Qatar. That's my personal opinion, was that I think we were probably ready for a change then, especially because it fell during the season as well. I think we could have managed that quite well. The fact it hasn't, the fact that he's playing Maguire and Henderson, I'm sort of siding with Alex in the sense of, you know, the likes of Lewis Duncan and Levi Colville. But if rumours to be believed, Levi Colville could have gone to Liverpool, and I think we're at one point rumoured to be preparing a bid. So he'd be playing Champions League football in 2 weeks because he's probably that good. And, you know, the fact that Maguire has, I think, is a bit of a moot point at the minute when, you know, I think us three would probably get a game at centre-half for Man United at the moment, considering how desperate they are, you know, with signing Johnny Evans. I mean, it's a bit of a crazy situation, isn't it? Especially because he's going to get sold to West Ham as well. I think looking at the bench and you see someone like Phil Foden, you've got Eze, and defensively you've got Tomori, Colwell and Dunk. I think they're all better players than who's on the pitch. And I think that's what it's got to come down to, but I can see him, if he doesn't win Euro 2024, I think that'll be it for England, for Gareth Southgate.
I mean, Alex, the notorious England handbrake that has afflicted many an England manager in the past. I think after reaching a World Cup semi-final, a European Championship final, and then making a retrograde step in you know, blunt terms at the last World Cup. You know, this is now the time, really, that, you know, he is only contracted to the end of the 2024 European Championship. This is the time to kind of like throw caution to the wind, really. You can't argue about what he's done, and all of the even down to kind of like winning in Italy in the qualifiers. The reigning European champions, albeit that, you know, a nation that perplexingly haven't qualified for the last two World Cups. If ever there was a time for England, an England manager to let the handbrake off and just let his team play and to kind of go for it, this is kind of the time, isn't it?
I suppose you could say that, but I think it's probably not changed in a great deal. If we'd flopped at any tournament, then Southgate would have been out. And I think that's very much at the back of his mind, that unless we get to the quarter, to the semi-finals, then he's out of a job. So he's obviously playing this safety first, nurses through the group stages and through the rounds. And every job, every match is his job on the line. And I just can't see him abandoning that approach that he's had so far. I think it is going to be this safety first, control the game, let it be a 1-0, a 2-1. Whatever you do, avoid it becoming an open match. I think the problem becomes when we do go behind, then changing that gear is quite problematic. But maybe that's a difficult thing to practice, because in a way you've got to go down first of all to allow that situation to happen. But I think you're right, that's what you'd like to see, but I just don't see it happening with Southgate. He's been clear and consistent in what he does, and I don't see him abandon it now.
I do think with that, though, there's got to come a point where if you're missing the last 10% to get you over the line, does that lie with the players or lie with the manager? And I think at the minute, I think it lies with the manager. I think we've got the extra 10% in the playing staff, but I'm not sure we've got it in the management team. And if that's the bit that's holding you back, that's what you've got to recognise. You know, if you're reflective and you want to improve and you're trying to be better for yourself, that's where he's got to recognise and think, actually, that last 10% is me with the handbrake on. It's me not putting it in fifth gear. So maybe we need to start trying to address that, because I do believe we've got the players to address that. And I think I do agree, Alex, that, you know, it must be an incredibly high pressure job being the England manager, because literally you will just get sacked if you get beat. And you know, he is someone who just wins games, but he hasn't won a tournament yet. And effectively, we've never looked under threat in any of the games, and yet here we are sitting without a trophy. And I think that's the biggest thing for him.
It is, I think it's that mental block that English football's always had. I mean, I'm looking at Group C there now. It's 13 points from 15. It's 4 wins, it's 1 draw, it's 16 goals scored, just 2 conceded. It sounds really impressive until you scratch the surface a little bit and find that, you know, 11 of those 16 goals have come against, what, Macedonia, North Macedonia and Malta. It's that holding. You know, it's the handbrake, it's the holding of the reins. There's a touch of the Bobby Robsons about it when, you know, the 1986 World Cup finals were, I think they scored something like 21 goals, yet 19 of them came against Finland and Turkey. You can look at the 1990 World Cup finals, the qualifiers there, 6 games, 9 goals scored, yet I think it was something like, something like 6 of those 9 were scored against Albania. It isn't just a Southgate thing. It's a perpetual English mentality to be conservative in that approach. And, you know, Alex, well, there's time for conservatism with football, but there's a time to be, you know, bolder. Could you see Southgate being able to do that? You know, and I suppose especially if it's, because if you look at it from where we are now, I mean, what, 13 points, the 6 clear of Ukraine, the 9 clear of Italy, and yes, Ukraine and Italy have games in hand and all that. But given that a 2014 tournament, you know, 4 of the 6 third place teams go through, there's an argument to be said that from this point to the last 16 of the 2024 European Championships is pretty much a smooth path for this England. This is a point in time where Southgate could prepare for the knockout stage. Without sound, it's not meant to sound arrogant, because, you know, that's an English way, and I'm not an England fan in general. I watch from a detached point of view almost. But that's the way I look. I'd be speaking in these terms if it was Italy in this position, if it was, you know, any, you know, nation with a World Cup or a European Championship to their honours list. Alex, you know, can it be that this you know, Southgate can come to an epiphany at some point and just be bold enough to go for it?
Again, I agree with both of you. I think that's the approach. Like you say, qualifying in good time is a fantastic opportunity to try different things, but I just don't see it coming. And I think one of the issues may be, think about Southgate's background, and really, unlike somebody like Ancelotti, who's mentioned about him joining the Brazil team and leading them, he hasn't got this tremendous experience and of different situations of being involved in these different things. We can draw a parallel, I think, with Sir Alex Ferguson in the 1990s when we're in the Champions League. You know, we look really, really naive. We were quite easily taken apart by teams because we didn't have that ability. We didn't know how to control games, how to change the tempo and things like that. And it was something that as a team we developed, and we became really, really savvy in the first decade of the new millennium. We really knew what to do, and we kind of turned the tables in many ways. But Southgate doesn't have that pot of experience that other managers would have. That Pep Guardiola has been linked with the job in the last couple of weeks and many times before, and he would be able to draw on that portfolio of quarterfinals, of semifinals in different competitions. And he's faced these things and he's failed before, and sometimes he's been successful. And it's that same thing. I don't think Southgate has that portfolio of experience and confidence to build on. You know, his international experience has been, I have to win this match every time. And I think that's probably a big limitation.
Fair points. Rob, moving away from England, just to throw a curveball in there this afternoon, Germany have sacked Hansi Flick after a 4-1 defeat in Wolfsburg against Japan. 2 of the goals coming in injury time. 7 games in this calendar year. They are 6 without a win. They beat Peru back in March. And since then, there has been a loss to Belgium, a draw, 3-3 draw with Ukraine, defeat in Warsaw against Poland, and losses either side of the summer to Colombia and now Japan on home soil. This is very un-German, un-Germanic. In so many respects, the kind of billing him as the first German manager to be sacked. you know, there's a bit of flexibility in that. Yep, Derwell was all but sacked in 84. Germany as hosts of the next European Championship, there's a tumultuousness about them at the minute, which is bordering on the hysterical. Out of the World Cup at the group stages in the winter, and now here we are in abject state.
Yeah, it's a very strange situation, I think, the German national team. I think it's hard to draw a parallel for them as well in sort of the situation that they find themselves in, because I think they probably are going through quite a transition after Jogi Löw was so successful for so long. I think is one of the key things, especially at international level, 15 years as the international manager in the modern era, you know, for a big nation is quite rare, especially because they often get offered big club jobs, which they very often take and move on and move away from a national team. They've still got a lot of talent. They've still got a lot of players that can do well. But I think it's a bit of a shift as to where their best players are and who their best players are and what stage of their career they're at. I think Germany often had a group of players that moved through from the youth setup into the national side and then got success off the back of that. And I think they're probably in that cycle where they probably need to just sort of pause, recheck where they're at, and then try and move again. Probably the early 2000s maybe was the time that you could sort of compare to this, possibly. Obviously before Klinsmann comes in and then sort of rejuvenates them, and they have the World Cup in 2006. That's a real positive for them. So maybe that's what they need. Maybe they need someone to come in who sort of only stays for a couple of years, bit of a caretaker manager type thing, bit of a Gus Hiddink effect, if you like, or Roberto Di Matteo, galvanize everyone, bring a team together, get into the next tournament, do everyone proud, and then you sort of build again and move on from that and then hope to have more success. But I am surprised that he only got that 2 years. But, you know, results speak volumes, and they have again, and he's gone.
I mean, Alex, Rob says there, you know, results speak volumes. Since the beginning of 2022, you know, inclusive of a poor World Cup in Qatar, they've played 19 times and won just, what, 4 times? Those wins coming against Israel, Oman, Costa Rica, which was the final group game at the 2022 World Cup. A win that, you know, didn't see them go through, and the start of the year with a victory against Peru. That's startling set of results. And Rudi Völler, the man who, I don't know, he's stepping in to take the helm in midweek against France in Dortmund. You know, he himself, you know, as kind of overlord at the DFB as such, has to take his responsibility for this as well, doesn't he?
It's very unusual. You look back 10 years and Germany seemed sort of insurmountable. And it's not like the talent well has dried up. I think that was definitely the problem in 2000 when, you know, Sebastian Deisler, I think, was probably one of only a couple of players under 23 in the squad. You know, they were really having a problem bringing through youth players. But, you know, the Özil generation was fantastic. And some fantastic players again. You know, Schlotterbeck, absolutely wonderful centre-back at Dortmund, and, you know, names we're more familiar with, like Gnabry and Sane. I wonder whether the presence is still a few, I know they're wonderful players, but likes of Gundogan, Thomas Müller still being in the team, whether sometimes you'd have to kind of chop that deadwood and give the next generation of leaders a time to go through. And it is very strange that it didn't work out, because Flick had such a successful period with Bayern and then moved straight on, and I think they started with like 8 wins or something like that. And then it's just gone all terribly sour, but the talent is there. Germany also has a lot of coaching talent, both domestically and abroad. I've no doubts they will sort it out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As long as they don't come to Anfield, I wish them well. Rob, they've got 4 more games to bring the year to a finish. Beyond France, they're off to the States in October, where they'll face the United States and Mexico in East Hartford and Philadelphia within the space of 4 days during the October international break. And then they'll face Austria in Vienna at the season's end. You'd have to think that an appointment will come beyond the France game and before heading off to the United States.
Yeah, definitely. I think that they'll try and get someone in there quickly, even if it's only on a short-term contract until the end of the European Championships. Julian Nagelsmann's been out of work for a little while. Stories that he's a little bit of an abrasive character may not go down too well with some of the characters that are actually in the Germany national squad, but I think he's a great coach. He's got a good pedigree. He can develop players a little bit like what Alex was saying with some of the younger players like Schlotterbeck. And then you've got someone like Florian Wirtz who's coming through, who's kind of a bit of a star. So, yeah, I mean, they're never out of the picture for too long as a national team, Germany, as we all know, over a long, long period of time. So I do expect them to try and sort it out sooner rather than later.
Alex, I'm going to do this about face. I'm giving you a challenging debut. Normally, I'd save the looking ahead bit to the end. But just because it marries up with in international terms. In the week ahead, you're looking forward to, you know, more of the Euro qualifiers, and in particular, some potentially left-field qualifiers, or at least nations that might still threaten qualification come October.
That's it. Well, I mean, I think it's nice. It's been so poisonous, the club scene, I think, over the last month or so. You know, we've hardly talked about the football, it seems, with various kind of scandals and the transfers and stuff like that. And so the first thing is it's nice to get back to the like purity of the international game. There's no transfers and things like that. So, you know, and we're talking about this idea of Germany. You know, it's this idea of teams ebbing and flowing naturally because you have this wonderful generation like Belgium and then you might not have something. And it's such a nicer flow than the likes of, you don't have a Bayern being dominant for 11 years or so on. So it's been nice that whole element. And then in particular, I think it goes against something you were saying last week, because everybody likes the big matchups. You know, if you see a World Cup quarterfinal, you see Italy, Argentina, or Brazil, France, you know that is going to be a fantastic game. But I think one of the things at the major tournaments in particular is what teams that aren't always there bring to it. We've seen from the home nations, I know this feeling isn't reciprocated towards England, but it's fantastic seeing Scotland qualify recently, Wales, Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland. You know, it's such a big deal to be involved in these summer tournaments. And each of these fan bases, you know, the Welsh fan base, Northern Irish fan base, you know, really brought something to the tournament that's been missing for a while. And on the negative side, you could see it as a dilution of the tournament, the fact that we're expanding to 24 teams. But on the other side, it does give more of those nations an opportunity to compete. And there are, looking at the tables just now, you know, a few teams that sort of perch right on the edge of qualifying for the first time. So we look, for example, Georgia, never qualified since their independence. They've got Kvaratskhelia, who obviously lit things up with Napoli last season. They've also got Mikotadze, who's just had a big money move to Ajax. So when you are one of these teams, you just need one or two really big players and you have a chance at qualifying. It would be great to see them and their fans. Similar sort of Armenia, whether they get Mkhitaryan out of retirement, there's Kazakhstan, there's Luxembourg, Israel, you know, series of teams that we either haven't seen or not seen for a while. And I think it'd just be nice to see a different set of fan bases, different style of football, maybe players that we haven't seen. I mean, the Kazakhstan team, only five of them play outside of their home nation. So they would be players who would be new to pretty much all of us. And then there's those that kind of haven't appeared for a while. I mean, it really struck me when I was looking at this with Norway that when I thought back to it, I thought, well, we haven't seen them for a while, but it's actually not since Euro 2000 that they've qualified. You know, to have Haaland, to have Ødegaard missing out on an international tournament seems an absolute crime. So, you know, I think they would be really competitive if they qualified. So, yeah, it's this idea of next summer, hopefully in Germany, no doubt be a fantastic tournament. The idea of seeing a few fresh new faces.
Rob, anyone in particular from that list of teams there that Alex has reeled off there that you'd like to see at the European Championships next summer?
Do you know what, I would absolutely love Luxembourg to get there. Because for how long, though, were they kind of, oh, you know, we've got Luxembourg, there's a 5-0 at home and a 3-0 away for every team who plays them in the group. Considering they've got 10 points in their group and they're just behind Slovakia on goal difference, and they're 7 points ahead of Iceland, who were conquering England in the European Championships not that long ago. I think one thing, we should never really credit FIFA and UEFA because most of their ideas are terrible. They never really know what they're doing. But the Nations League has really given a team like Luxembourg the chance to say, we're going to play against teams that are a similar ability to us. Let's try and develop tactically, individually, and as a group. And if you look at them, they are reaping the rewards. And to a certain extent, I think Scotland are similar as well. They really are reaping the benefits of that. And I think Alex's team might need to reassess where Scott McTominay plays. Could he be the new Bruno Fernandes, finishing and scoring a ton of goals for Man United? Who knows?
Who knows indeed, who knows? But yeah, I echo that. Luxembourg at the finals of a major international tournament would be absolutely outstanding. I mean, Alex, if you could handpick just one of those nations, who would you plug for?
I think Georgia. I think I like teams to go in there with a bit of a chance. Like I say, you only need one or two players. You know, Wales had a good group of players, but they had those two, Bale and Ramsey, that really stood out. And I think you need that bit to kind of elevate you above. And certainly those two, Kvaratskhelia and Mikatadze, would do that.
Absolutely. My Dinamo Tbilisi soft spot would definitely kind of like embrace Georgia reaching Germany next summer. Within that, there is as well, I don't know, you look at that group J is very attractive. There's no doubt. I mean, Luxembourg are probably on a high into, well, surely on a high into nothing in midweek. Is it this midweek that they go to? No, not this midweek, is it? Yes, they do. Do they go to Portugal this midweek? And then, there's points beyond that, you know, that are certainly winnable for Luxembourg. They've got the visit of Slovakia to come in October. They have got the visit of Bosnia Herzegovina in November. They've already won away to Bosnia Herzegovina, and beyond the trip to Portugal, they've still to go to Ireland and Liechtenstein. There's definitely points in this for Luxembourg, without a shadow of a doubt. But yeah, what a finish! It is going to be a very, very interesting finish. I mean, looking at through some of the other groups as well, even from the mid ranging, you know, nations, I'd be delighted to see Romania get there. Although it will be at the expense of an Israel, perhaps, but Israel in with a shout to going into the playoffs due to the Nation League exploits. Always glad to see Hungary doing so well. You know, they're kind of a team of purpose. You know, I grew up with Hungary being a decent team and qualifying for major international tournaments. There's, you know, with what, four or five games to go for the vast majority, it's going to be an interesting finish to the qualifications. Alex, coming back to you, having spoken a little bit of German football matters away from international football, you wanted to talk about the blossoming, doesn't seem the right word, but the embracing of new challenges away from the Premier League, certainly the case of Harry Kane, but also Jude Bellingham's shift from Dortmund and the Bundesliga to Real Madrid, and just how well both have started with the new employers.
Yeah, again, I'm trying to turn some negatives into positives. I mean, there's been a lot of, especially in the United front, a lot of negative coverage of England players. And yeah, it's fantastic to have these two players in particular doing so well. I mean, you know, Kane 3-3 Bundesliga games, and I think beyond that, there's just the fact that he's really settled in as well. They've clearly recognised that as a character, he's very dependable. He has a lot to give the younger players in terms of the development, and yeah, he's really being valued. And even more spectacularly, Jude Bellingham, 5 goals in 4 games. Not something you'd associate. Again, I watched him at quite close quarters, so I have Borussia Dortmund as kind of a second club, and he was absolutely magnificent. But you know, maybe half a dozen, 7 goals at the most in a season, and he's been moved a little bit forward into a number 10 position. And just his cleverness, you know, he's so adaptable, and he's absolutely raining goals at the moment. And just like Kane, really been taken to by the fans almost immediately. Yeah, I think it's just fantastic to see English players doing well abroad. You know, there are others out there. I think we talked about Tomori. Obviously, Tammy Abraham's injured at the moment, but he's doing fantastically at Roma. Chris Smalling. We'll talk again about Ruben Loftus-Cheek, no doubt, in a minute. But yeah, fantastic to see. Very new, really, that as I was growing up in the 90s, we had a few players, likes of Sharp and others, kind of test the water in Italy. But there weren't so many that were successful. And then there were relatively few over the last 20 years. And then it seems over the last few years that players have developed this kind of confidence and there's kind of a steady stream of English, also Scottish, Welsh and Irish players now going abroad.
I mean, Rob, Alex comes up with some great points there. There was a lull, I think, through the noughties and the 2010s maybe, that it was only a certain demographic of British player that was venturing abroad. But now it's, you know, I don't know, it's becoming a bit of a blast for the past, really. I mean, I grew up in an era in which, like, the best players from Britain went and plied their trade, especially in Italy, but prior, you know, also the Bundesliga at times, and in Spain, Lineker, Rush, you know, Hughes all went, Keegan, as far back as 77. To Hamburg, even down to managers, you know, Venables, Kendall, Toshack, you know, all headed off to the Atkinson for a short period in time. Once upon a time, the players and managers were keen and eager to bail out on the British game, somewhat understandably in a way. But then, you know, the Premier League era, certainly beyond the first decade of it, and the increase in revenue that was seen. There was no real reason for players to kind of go and try the hand abroad. I can remember Daniel Diccio tipping up at Sampdoria and thinking, that's very, very different to what I've been used to. No disrespect to Daniel Diccio, but, you know, not the calibre of, you know, you look at, say, Liverpool winning the European Cup in 84 and the European Cup winning captain moving to what was mid-table Sampdoria club at that time without a major trophy to the name. You know, so in structural football terms seems a bit mad, but in lifestyle terms and financially and be able to challenge yourself amongst the greats of the game, you know, understandable. But, you know, there's a generation of players that have, you know, changed the attitude in that respect. And, you know, I think some of them, like Bellingham, have gone into a younger age. It's definitely a generational change. And for Harry Kane to kind of try his hand like this is quite an eye-opener as well.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think one of the major shifts from that 90s and 2000s period is the technical ability of our younger players has increased exponentially. In that period of time, 90s and noughties, you know, there was still probably a culture where youth football wasn't as technical because it was all to do with developing first team ready players. You know, they played in the reserves with other first teamers, got kick lumps out of them, and if they survived, they got in the first team. Whereas now it's very much, I mean, a much better system in the fact that on the pitch, that players are technically able to play in different systems and different styles and different ways. And that's probably been a criticism of British players, certainly over a period of time, maybe being tactically astute. But again, you probably have to say it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because the Premier League brought in a lot of players and managers from abroad. So we had fewer British players in teams. But their influence has actually meant that British players have improved. So it'd be interesting to see where we are in 10 or 20 years' time and if that's shifted even further. I think Jadon Sancho's another one who left Manchester City's academy to get a chance abroad, excelled in Dortmund and now looks incredibly lost under the bright lights at Old Trafford. I was thinking about Bellingham. I wonder if he'll get to a point where he never plays in the Premier League but be the greatest player of his generation. That is a question that I've got about Bellingham, and I'd kind of love it if that was true, because the Premier League is this big behemoth that dominates, you know, everything in football, doesn't it? But wouldn't it be great if the best player of the next 10 years never played there? I just think that would be a really interesting little quirk of fate, to be honest.
I agree with that, Rob. I mean, what people were saying about Jude Bellingham, you know, as far as like at the World Cup was concerned, was you know, as a 19-year-old at that point in time, is, you know, his intelligence and just how mature he was. And you get the feeling that, would he be that same person to have had that amount of development, you know, had he, you know, moved from Birmingham City to, you know, a big six Premier League club. I mean, Alex, Bellingham's an exceptional talent, and, you know, the unreal start that he's had for Real Madrid, and it's delightful to see. You know, the concept of Bellingham, you know, never play pulling on a Premier League shirt. It's an intriguing one, but I could fully expect it to happen given his current position.
Going back, I think it's maybe a chicken and an egg situation. You say, obviously, going abroad will have brought maturity to him, but I think he showed his maturity by making that decision as well, that he could have joined Manchester United. And I have to say, I think he would have been in a very different position. He made that mature choice, the brave choice to go abroad to get Champions League football straight away. And I honestly cannot speak highly enough of him. I can't remember the last time I've seen probably Rooney is the last player who had that much talent in so many areas of the game. You know, he's combative and physical, and he has all those attributes that you'd want in the Premier League, but he's a very, very technical player, you know, very, very gifted, great touch, great range of passing. And I think the thing that makes him stand out is his mentality. It's just absolutely extraordinary. I was at the game against Rangers at Ibrox last season, and about 60 minutes in, I think it became sort of a viral thing, but Nico Schultz, the left back, played a pass in the wrong position, and Schultz hadn't had a great game, and Bellingham just turned round and gave him a kind of Keno-esque volley of abuse. And you've got to remember, he's a 19-year-old kid. Again, this is an international 28-year-old left back, and just that kind of character, that demand, that drive, whichever team he plays for in his career, it will be of massive service. I mean, you know, he was named captain at 19. Like, what kind of creature does that happen to? And I've no doubt he'd be a future England captain. But everything you've seen about him, he's taken everything in stride. First season at Championship, like a duck to water, goes into the Champions League, Bundesliga, again, just adapts to it. And it wasn't really a surprise that he just seems no limit to what he can do. You know, he's so talented, but also sort of his approach to things is so grounded that you feel he would just continue to be a success. And really, it's probably injury that could be the only thing that could hold him back.
I mean, Rob, Alex comes up with some great points there, that, you know, if ever a player was kind of built to be, you know, a Premier League legend, Jude Bellingham is the identical player for that kind of, you know, position, really. Which in respect would make it even more likeable if he was to forever shun the shiny laminated land of the Premier League.
Yeah, definitely. I think Alex is your comparison to Rooney there, Alex, I think is really pertinent, because he's got a lot of minutes in those knees already at a very high level, and I think that he needs to have a really good 8 to 10 years at Real Madrid for me and win everything and build a great team. They've got Vinicius there. They've got Rodrigo, Valverde, Camavinga, Tchouameni. They've got Endrick coming over from Brazil when he leaves school, because it feels like some of these Brazilians are signed as so young. I think Endrick's going over when he's 18. So the sort of team that he'll be part of, you probably won't find a better setup than that, probably in his career. And he's really got to take advantage of it, because aside from everything else, he's just fantastic to watch. Watch it. Do you know, he's probably the closest thing you're going to get to like a Roy Keane plus Patrick Vieira plus Steven Gerrard plus Frank Lampard plus Paul Scholes all in one player. I think he has got so many different facets to his game that, honestly, who thought he was going to be the number 10 for Real Madrid? Not in numerical, obviously, number 5. But playing in that role as a number 10, you think, it's just how good he is at this age is frightening, frightening.
Unreal. And as a player, you look at him and think he can only get better and better. I think, you know, it's true. Only injuries could possibly, you know, slow him down. You know, absolutely incredible. And it's great to see so many British players excelling and embracing, the league, various leagues across Europe. It's such a sea change from what we've been used to. Moving on, it is domestic terms. League Two has pretty much had it to itself this weekend. It's had the floor, and it's been an intriguing start to the campaign in League Two. Mansfield Town under Nigel Clough, unbeaten so far. Good reaction to back-to-back defeats for Gillingham in win at the weekend. A victory that put them top of the table thanks to Notts County and MK Dons sharing the spoils in the land of the concrete cows and the roundabouts. Notts County and Wrexham, after, a tumultuous first week or so of conceding goals, have began to find the feet. Wrexham are still shipping goals, but they're managing more often than not to score goals more than they concede. Notts County, out of the two of them, have settled the faster, I think, there. Interesting to see the hangovers as well from the teams who lost out in the playoffs last season: Stockport County, Salford City, Bradford City, all labouring somewhat. There's been a positive response from MK Dons after their relegation from League One, but there are difficulties at Doncaster over. Sutton United, who put five past Wrexham on the opening day, have not picked up a win since. And Tranmere Rovers somewhat shooting themselves in the foot as well. Rob, League Two, very much left to its own devices this season. And if you were looking for domestic football to keep an eye on, that was, a couple of fixtures in League One, but it was the only league in town as far as the top four professional leagues was concerned.
Yeah, and there's some fantastic names in League Two, and there's some great players, and there's a lot of good football that gets played. There's a lot of progressive teams, clubs, coaches, Notts County being one of them. If anybody watched Notts County in the National League last year, very much a ball-dominant, possession-based team who've adapted really quickly. My favourite part about League Two, okay, so Gillingham are top of the league with 15 points. They've scored 5 goals in 7 games. They've also conceded 5. And I looked this up earlier on because I was thinking, how have they got 5 wins from scoring 5 goals? There's only been one team that has scored in any of their games. So every single game has been to nil. So all of their wins are 1-0, which I mean... that's just brilliant in itself. And then they've lost 3-0 and 2-0 in the games that they've got beat. So we were saying before about England, if they go 1-0 up and you're kind of going to control the game. But of Gillingham, absolute masters, because they score a goal and that's it. A couple of late goals in their games, to be fair. Swindon are the other team that really stick out for goals. Quite a few teams are hitting the back of the net pretty early. But yeah, Swindon, Jake Young's has been pretty good for them and Daniel Kemp. But the fact that they've been on loan from teams within the league who are now seeing their players do brilliantly well is quite incredible, because it doesn't really happen in many other leagues. But, I mean, you look through some of the teams, and like you say, Bradford and Salford City, they did not expect to be where they are after this early point in the season. But this league, honestly, you get a couple of wins, you get a bit of form together, and, by January, you're 15 points clear at the top. Or, you're in a battle for the playoffs. So it's always a really exciting league, and it's definitely not disappointed in the start that they've made so far.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Alex, the thing about League Two is just how tumultuous it can be. I mean, we're looking at Gillingham top of the table, we're talking about a league that's, seven games old for the vast majority, a couple of teams on 6 games. Gillingham sit at the top of the table. They finished 17th at the end of last season. As I said, you've got the three teams who lost out in the playoffs are all water treading in the bottom half of the table at the moment. You've got as well, interesting to see Crawley and Wimbledon up in the top half. They were kind of flirting somewhat with relegation to the Football League. All of this could turn sour, and it could turn around for the clubs that haven't started so well. But, I always look at Tranmere Rovers as well. Over the other side of the water, Kristen Dennis picked up. He'll be 34 in March, but had been a free scoring nomad for many years, and scored a lot of goals for Carlisle United last season. Yeah, there they are, sat in 22nd place malfunctioning. You know, I think it's just one of those. It's one of those leagues with a great volatility to it. But as well, I'm looking at kind of like teams like Colchester and thinking, you know, they had a difficult end to last season and a difficult start to this season. So you know, if you're looking for potential, you know, to look out for, you know, a club in Colchester United who have been in the Football League for about just over 30 years, I think, since they went down in the early days of relegation and promotion to and from the Football League. Interesting, you know, for a friend of the podcast, we like to call him, Adam Summerton, who does the commentaries for TNT Sports on a great deal of levels of football, a lot of Serie A, you know, Premier League games here and there, European games. But he gets a huge amount of enjoyment out of covering the National League. And, you know, he was in an interesting Twitter spat with a former owner of Notts County, actually, yesterday, who the former owner of Notts County, you know, being very vocal in trying to shout down Adams, you know, long-held arguments for three up, three down. But, you know, his interesting point being that there's never been a football team relegated or, you know, straight back down to the National League from League Two. You know, we look at League Two, you know, and the National League, there's not much between them, you know, to split them. I wasn't going to bring the National League into this one, but I just find that bottleneck at the bottom end of League Two and at the top end of the National League, you're looking at a National League there that's inhabited half the teams of former league clubs, and there's more further down the divisions, and there's another seven or eight in the National League's North and South, if you're counting Phoenix, you know, clubs as well. And this League Two, I think, counted up yesterday, there's 18 of the 24 have won promotion from the fifth tier into the fourth tier, and there's many more. I think half of League One as well. So well over kind of 30 clubs, because there's more higher up as well. Obviously, Luton Town goes as far as the Premier League. About 9 years on from climbing out of the National League. League Two, you know, within this, and it's part in it. It goes unconsidered as a league a lot of the time. People look at League One and think, you know, there's so many big teams now. We looked at it last season and how Ipswich Town, Plymouth Argyle, Sheffield Wednesday were so far ahead of everyone else. But in a league that contained Bolton Wanderers, Derby County, you know, Premier League refugees, basically, you know, Portsmouth, another one. You know, we talk often about the intrigue and, you know, the joy of the National League, but League Two tends to fall under the radar a little bit. Not necessarily a fair thing, though, Alex.
Like you said, I think the Championship, League One, League Two, there's just much more flow, isn't there, between those that you say the Premier League, you have quite a good idea with some predictability who's going to be in those different places. But, you know, you just mentioned Luton, you know, nobody would have had them appearing in the Premier League, and it's the same. You know, we can see again Gillingham wouldn't have thought they would be up there when other bigger spenders would be languishing in sort of mid or lower table. I view it as a kind of an outsider, as somebody who's not supported a club that's been in the conference or the League Two, but it does seem like it is really hampering the ability of those top semi-pro and low professional clubs to develop, the fact that there is this bottleneck. And, you know, we saw it last season, didn't we, with Wrexham and Notts County, that again, you if you've got one or two teams that are spending a lot, you're not leaving room for the rest of the teams. Whereas in League One, in the Championship, you've got more space. There's a quarter of the league can have some potential to be involved in promotion. And again, from an outside of view, opening up that and having more flow seems like it would improve the healthiness and the competitive between the two leagues. And going back to what you and Rob said, yeah, there's just so many fantastic stories in there, aren't there? Obviously, Gillingham taking this early lead, and it's a long old winter, and we'll sort of see whether they're still there at the end. But Notts County and Wrexham attracted a lot of attention with their tussle last season, and it's continued. And as you say, they seem to have really well adapted to that new level. And we knew Wrexham would spend a decent amount. I mean, they've just signed Stephen Fletcher, obviously fantastic pedigree as an international and Premier League player. You know, McGoldrick, 22 goals in the league above the season, last season, appearing for Notts County. You know, they've got the funds to support themselves and they seem to be doing quite well. But then, as you said, you look down the league and there's a cautionary tale, particularly for Wrexham of Salford City, who were that kind of media darling, had the spotlight. And despite putting a lot of money in, they found it very difficult. They've been there or thereabouts around the playoff the last few seasons, but have sort of struggled to get out. And say other teams who are involved with the playoffs. I mean, Stockport County, very local to me, just around the ring road. And incredible, some of the quality of players that are appearing in this fourth tier. I mean, Nick Powell, I thought he was very promising at United and thought he was unfortunate not to get a go. But, you know, he's a good player at Championship level. And for a League Two team to be able to snag him, I thought that was, you know, absolutely fantastic. And actually, talking about Tranmere, there's the connection with long throw specialist Dave Challoner being their gaffer. Yeah, and I suppose the other side, Graham Alexander, obviously, have been sacked by Salford City and now in charge of very unpopular, for good reason, MK Dons, again, looking to sort of go up again. But wherever you look, you say Salford, Wrexham, this Gillingham appearing, you've got Bradford and, you know, massive name in Mark Hughes. There's just stories all over the division.
Absolutely. I mean, Rob, it's you know, it does fall under the radar for the vast majority of us, me included. You know, I mean, I sat last night and watched the highlights on the ITV, and I was interested to see how they cope without kind of like Championship highlights and stuff like that. And to be fair to them, they gave lead to the big the big billing and went through some magnificent goals scored yesterday. You know, a great game between MK Dons and Notts County, and some really, it was a great eye opener. But yeah, I'm familiar with so many of the clubs. But yeah, it's a peculiar landscape, and I think it's probably going to change from next season because I think there's a new football league deal with Sky, which will involve much more, games from League One and League Two being broadcast live as well. But it's a strange situation in that, we get so many games broadcast across the Premier League, so many games broadcast from the Championship. And then there's that kind of Bermuda Triangle of not many games shown live from League One and League Two. And then you get kind of like, must be about 30 or 40 live games that TNT Sports show of the National League. The peculiar situation being that the top flight, the second tier, and then the fifth tier is then suddenly like the most exposed league as far as live coverage is concerned. It's understandable that League One and more so League Two fall under the radar for so many people.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it just shows you how television has driven football development in this country. So you've got the Premier League is the top league to be shown. The Championship is shown because it's a path to the Premier League. The National League is shown because it's a path to league football. So you've sort of got that built-in jeopardy at those three levels out of the top five, whereas League One and Two, we've all sort of said that it's quite a lot of movement between League One and League Two. You look at like Forest Green, who were fantastic in League Two, but really couldn't do it in League One, partly because you had some Championship behemoths who come down and then just sort of have that little bit of extra money and they're more dominant. I do also think there's another sort of part of this that I know football's always been quite tribal, but I do feel like there is certainly a lot more tribalism in newer football fans who probably are fans more of players and clubs than the actual game itself. So probably wouldn't just casually watch a match that might be on from the National League or League One or League Two if it's local to them in midweek. Because obviously most of the EFL plays a midweek game every other week or every third week. And at that level, it's probably not unaffordable to go and attend a team that's not too far away. So, I mean, it is a shame. There's still some great clubs there who get good attendances and play some good football. And a lot of the time, it's a great league for seeing the next sort of level of player develop if you're a Championship club, because you often see quite a lot of loan players out there. So it is a shame that this does get sort of lost a little bit. But I do think there's also a discussion to be had about the fact we have 92 professional clubs in league football and more in the National League, which is so unique, but does create naturally a dilution of fans and television rather than maybe two top leagues, for example. But that certainly would be an unpopular thing to happen, I think, certainly in the future in English football. But definitely, I mean, you look at last season, how close it can get for playoffs and promotion races, and I think it's definitely going to be the same again this season as well.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's always the thing that struck me about League Two, is the volatility of it in so many ways. You know, we have the Premier League where, you know, obviously we've got the top six now, you know, top seven or so. You know, you have that middle ground of teams you know, tend to do, you know, water tread somewhat, and then you'll get maybe kind of like six, seven, eight who are interchangeable with the top end of the Championship. You know, the Championship being, you know, something of a demolition derby a lot of the time. League One, an unforgiving league where you have a mix of kind of teams that have dropped out of the Championship and teams who aren't strong enough to make the step up, as we've intimated there with Forest Green. Not really strong enough to maintain a place in League One. Wimbledon have been in that respect as well. Tranmere Rovers were another one. You know, teams that have gone up from League Two and just you know, slipped back down again, either at the first time of asking or very quickly. But then you have, you know, League Two, and it's tumultuous nature because you get teams who go in from the National League who are, you know, adept and you know, in there with a chance of staying, not just staying, but you know, angling for promotion again, as you know, was the case with Stockport County, came to within a penalty shootout of second successive promotion last season. And Notts County and Wrexham are, you know, stating their early cases to be included in the promotion fight again this season. But yeah, League Two will be a fascinating one to keep an eye on. Sticking to all things EFL, if we want to call it by its horrendous contemporary name. Rob, you're looking forward to an intriguing Championship fixture this coming Friday.
Yeah, as a team who are stuck in the doldrums of the Championship, looking jealously towards Premier League clubs, I'm going to pick a Championship game. So Friday night is Southampton versus Leicester City, and it's the money derby of the Championship. Generously receiving parachute payments from those paymasters in the Premier League, and also generously receiving €287 million in transfer sales, which is quite astonishing to watch a football match where over €250 million worth of players have been sold. I just think it's incredible. And it really is symptomatic of where we're at in the Championship now and in the Premier League. You know, two teams that have spent money, two teams that have been like shining lights for other, and I'm going to say smaller clubs, because they are smaller clubs in, compared to the top of the table, who'd survive well, they developed, they had good players, they had young players coming through, played some exciting football. Leicester won the league. You know, they've had all of that there. Now that they're in the Championship, and probably going to dominate. Generously will be supported by 70, 80 million pounds plus from the Premier League for parachute payments to pay for wages and whatever. Goodness knows what they're going to spend the €250 million on that they've achieved with their parachute payments. Maybe they might just get a bit of a jolly at the end of the season, an extra, you know, upgrade in Las Vegas when they get a promotion winning party. But should be a good game of football. Leicester have got Pep Guardiola Mark II, including the bald head in charge from Enzo Maresca. And Southampton have got Mr. 1,000 Passes, Russell Martin, who is now at a club where he's got to prove that passing the ball a lot and keeping the ball a lot actually brings results. So I do think it'll be a really interesting game. They might need two footballs, considering how much both teams want to keep the ball. Leicester have not been as convincing, really, despite their good start. Some of their results maybe not been as... Sorry, the performance has maybe not been as good as the accumulation of results that they've achieved. But if these two teams do not come first and second in the league, it will finally prove that the Championship is the craziest league that ever existed in football.
I mean, Alex, it is an intriguing game, without a shadow of a doubt, for all the reasons Rob's mentioned there. And also, this it's going to be a statement of intent, really. You know, what we've had is that Leicester have lost their last game at home to Hull City somewhat unexpectedly. You know, although that put Hull up into sixth place, Southampton absolutely, you know, decimated 5-0 by Sunderland. The Championship, as all of the Football League, is massively unforgiving. They as Rob said, they do have every tool at their disposal, Leicester City and Southampton, to finish first and second. But both off the back of a defeat, you know, a second successive loss would start to kind of see questions raised about prospects of going straight back up for whichever team was to, well, obviously a draw is possible. But it's, again, early in the season, but it's a massive scene setter, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. As you say, the Rob outlined very well, the positive is both managers have backbone of experienced Premier League players to call upon, and they've also been able to add to that with a few kind of key acquisitions of players who've got experience within the division. But with that comes that pressure, as you say, that the expectation is, understandably, you know, your wage bill is double that most of your competitors, so you need to go and win this. So I think that, as Rob said, I'd be very surprised, although this is exactly the league in which this happens, if both weren't right there and we weren't see them back in the Premier League next season. Both have got really good backbone. I mean, one of the things is strikes me as extraordinary is, as Rob said, you've sold £250 million of players, but these are players that got relegated from the Premier League. So, you know, the idea that they hold their value so well, you know, £40-50 million midfielder, for example. But, say, very similar in terms of their lineups. You know, both look very, very strong. A couple of young players in there, but largely a lot of experience at Championship and Premier League level. And probably the biggest difference is the managers. You know, Russell Martin sort of served his stripes previously in the Championship, whereas Enzo Maresca is a bit like Arteta. I mean, apart from a short spell at Parma, it's a bit like this Arteta model of coming through as a disciple of Guardiola and then being unleashing his philosophy on the Championship.
I mean, Rob, it's a massive battle. I mean, it clearly Maresca will have looked at Vincent Kompany and how well he did in leading Burnley out of this division last season, and doing so, playing an attractive brand of football. Maresca, an interesting way for Leicester to have gone in the summer appointment.
Yeah, definitely. I think Kompany's time in Belgium, managing a big club like Anderlecht, is such a good base. Like Alex says, Maresca is the Arteta of the Championship. He's got to work it out. And if you remember what Arteta was like when he first got to Arsenal, he was working it out, and credit to Arsenal for allowing that to happen. But Maresca is putting in place a very ambitious system. It's a sort of a 3-4-3 variation that sort of is fluid and mixes up and changes, and, you know, you can't really sort of classify what they're actually doing sometimes in terms of their sort of tactical structure. None of their results have really been massively convincing, I would say, in terms of what they've been doing. They haven't blown anyone away. Southampton, you know, a lot of people were surprised when they had 795 million passes in the first game against Sheffield Wednesday, but again, that's a little bit of TV naivety, I always think, because Russell Martin's been doing that at Swansea and done it for a couple of years. So it's interesting to see them get turned over by Sunderland, who've had their own issues in terms of getting young players in and whatnot. But, I mean, Kompany was a fantastic example of, if you can get a manager who's already managed before and who's got that feeling of being a top three, top four manager, dealing with the pressure, dealing with buying new players, it can work. Maresca is a risk, I think. Daniel Farker at Leeds is a lot less of a risk because he's won it twice before, but maybe the squad's got a little bit more disruption, especially with what had happened with Nonto as well. I mean, I was almost going to say, I love the Championship. I think it's brilliant, but as a Middlesbrough fan, I would obviously love to be in the Premier League, but it is a great league for that. There's so many different stories within it. And I think you alluded to it a little bit earlier, Stephen, that the Football League will have 10 live fixtures every single weekend from next season, which is just incredible. And hopefully it means that they get that wider audience, because there's so many stories that kind of move in, and there's so many parallels with big clubs doing well and not doing well, and my own club with a single point at the bottom of the table after finishing fourth. I just think it's going to be a really good game to watch just because of the stories and the managers and the transfers and the money. And yeah, it'll feel like a really bad Premier League game to most people, but in Championship terms, it'll probably be a good quality one.
Yeah, again, it's that volatility, Alex, isn't it? I mean, I'm looking at the Championship table here, and there's Ipswich second place at the minute, having won promotion from League One last season. The one game that they lost was, you know, by the skin of the teeth against Leeds United. They're the only game that Leeds have won so far this season. You know, it's such a strange kind of aura to this, isn't it? It's always been the case. Hull City, you know, were so abject for much of last season, you know, with a pretty bright start. You've got mirroring in a way League Two in the, you know, Sunderland, Coventry City and Middlesbrough in particular, sorry Rob, but you know, the three teams that lost out in the playoffs have all had dysfunctional starts to the season. Sunderland are, you know, looking like the quickest to remedy that. I can't see Middlesbrough staying down there for long. I hope I'm not, you know, put the hex on there, but even
thanks,
the teams promoted, you look at Sheffield Wednesday shooting. I know I've done it now, haven't I? But Sheffield Wednesday shooting themselves in the foot in the departure of Darren Moore and how all that went on. You know, three teams who looked very balanced against one another in League Two, and you've got Ipswich in second, Plymouth 10th, and Sheffield Wednesday 23rd. You know, we're only five games into the season, but you know, this is it's the foundation that these, you know, seasons and campaigns will unfold. Alex, anything else that's taking your eye in the Championship?
I suppose a few things that being in the Northwest, and I suppose just a general football fan, that there's always this lurking thing with Preston threatening to go up at some point. Had a good period last season, and yeah, they're top at the moment. I wouldn't expect them to stay there. You know, their resources are absolutely minuscule, but I mean, I would absolutely love to see them. I think the closest they got was sort of talking like David Healy and John Macken, kind of David Moyes era. But yeah, them being up there, I can't see them staying, but I would like them to. Ipswich Town, I mean, one of the criticisms of the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer reign was that he had these very kind of baby-faced coaches and there was real no coaching expertise. And McKenna's shown that to be anything but the case. You know, he's been fantastic with Ipswich promotion last season, his first managerial job, and then doing a great job in the Championship, sort of taken to that straight away. I would have added Carrick to that because obviously he did a fantastic job last season. It not quite worked, but yeah, that kind of interest from my side, because there's a lot of criticism of them because of their youth, but doing a good job. It won't look like this at the end of the season. Southampton and Leicester, you would be, they are the two you're confident about. I think Leeds is just so much upheaval there in many different ways. And then the rest, you could sort of put a pin in a board, I think, as usual.
Absolutely, absolutely. And moving away from English club football to the Midland Derby, which is the one I'm looking forward to this coming, well, next weekend. Both of Milan's big clubs have started well this season. Three wins out of three. This is, I don't know, bragging rights. There's a point to prove for Milan having lost the Champions League semi-final. There's a lot of layers to this game coming in. Out of the two teams, it's Milan who I think have recruited and managed to keep hold of players a lot more. Intriguingly, Ruben Loftus-Cheek having been mentioned earlier in the podcast by Alex. Christian Pulisic has had an absolutely wonderful start to life at Milan. Oliver Giroud, you know, frowned upon for a lot of his time at Milan, has started with a blizzard of goals. Rafa Leao has started the season exceptionally well again. Another player that they've done well to keep hold of. Again, the English. British link with Fikayo Tomori still being such an omnipresent figure for Milan. There was the tumultuousness of Paolo Maldini's departure as well from behind the scenes as part of this. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword in that respect for Milan. And Inter, you know, they do have the hangover of losing the Champions League final to get over. which might be kind of like one of the kindest hangovers that I can't imagine that they have expected to reach the Champions League final last season. But they've started with three back-to-back victories, yet to concede a goal. You know, wins against Monza, Cagliari and Fiorentina. Four past Fiorentina at the last last outing. You know, this is always a special fixture. And, you know, Lautaro Martinez has started the season exceptionally well. There is the danger for Inter. I think that, you know, the danger that there could be a one-man band as such, that they're not going to rely too much on Lautaro Martinez. I think there's possibly more scope for Milan to be able to spread the goals around. You know, you do fear a little bit for Inter if they lose such an omnipresent figure at some point in Lautaro Martinez to injury. But yeah, Alex, the Milan derby, such an icon. And even, you know, Serie A has kind of, I don't know, re-imaged itself. It used to be the plateau, the high plateau of club football, in certain European terms, in global terms as well. You know, it's kind of turned itself into a bit of a hipster league in the last 3 years. That breaking of the Juventus stranglehold of nine successive Serie A titles. We've had Inter, we've had Milan, and now Napoli, you know, taking the Serie A title, inclusive of Juventus's last of the nine in a row. That's four different champions in the last four seasons. But the Milan derby this Saturday, it's, you know, again, we talk of statements of intent, of scene setters, of planting a flag. You know, this is as big as it's going to get so far in Serie A this season. You know, what a game ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing is it is at San Siro, and there's been lots of talk about its future. I mean, the two teams will move away from there, but the stadium itself has been granted a stay of execution. So it's deemed of historical interest, which I think nobody on this conversation would disagree with. I would say to anybody who hasn't visited it, it is an absolutely fantastic stadium. And if you get an opportunity, particularly for some of the smaller games, it is very quite easy to get tickets. So I really would encourage you to go and see it. It's absolutely unforgettable. Two massive teams in really good form at the start of this season. I think, again, it's going to be a very open league. So Napoli have lost a coach. So Spalletti's now had this period of absence. He wanted a year off, but now he's joined the Italian team. They've also lost their technical director, who was kind of implicated. He had a really important role in many of their acquisitions, and they've not started so well under Rudy Garcia. And you could see that maybe their bubble, if not quite bursting, that they won't be as strong this season. You've got really the other possible competitor is Juve, and again, they're still reeling from that 10-point deduction. Haven't really made a lot of kind of key signings or anything that would suggest that they're back on the way onto their pedestal. So it does really seem like it's all to fight for the two Milanese sides. And as you say, in good form, some good acquisitions. Pulisic, I was fortunate enough to watch at Dortmund. He's a fantastically talented player. And as we've learned nothing over the last decade, that one thing that we have learned is that if you flop at Chelsea, it doesn't necessarily mean you're a bad player. I mean, you know, Salah and KDB would attest to that. But
it's quite the stepping stone to great
to greatness. That's it. So Mudrick, put him on for Ballon d'Or 2030.
Absolutely.
But yeah, as you said, that front three is Liao and the evergreen Giroud and Pulisic. Looks really kind of tantalising, and it would be whether that really well-organised defence. We saw how robust they were in the Champions League final against that kind of relentless pressing onslaught of Manchester City, the Inter defence, and be a question of whether they can hold out against that force. But yeah, fantastic game in prospect, fantastic league in prospect. The only thing I would say is it does kind of set in place, you know, how far Italian football has fallen, as you mentioned. You know, in the 90s, the early 2000s, the big money signings, it was Kaká and the likes going to the Italian league. And it's just a cautionary note for the Premier League that appears completely unassailable, its position as the number one league. But same with Italy in the 90s and Serie A. And, you know, things can change and things will change. And it's a very different league, you know, in terms of, you look at things like the revenue, it's very much even behind the Bundesliga now in terms of revenue. We see that in the signings that are being made, you know, Juventus, Milan, not putting out anything in terms of transfer fees like the other clubs and having to be a lot more savvy. And as you say, into losing a couple of their key players as well.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, I'm looking at it there, and Milan's, you know, three wins, you know, against a heavily fancied Bologna, Torino, who, you know, can make it hard, life hard, and to go and win in Rome. That's an impressive start for Milan. Three wins out of three is impressive for anyone, but I think in particular, if you were looking at a team to shade this, then, you know, and a spring in the stair. You know, both are going to feel that way into not in conceding a goal so far. I just think it's going to be massively, massively interesting this Saturday, you know, as it always is. But yes, I think in a way, the way that Serie A has changed, it's kind of, you know, degraded isn't the right word, but it's not what it was. You know, the fact that it can be, like you mentioned, of Pulisic, and it can be a rehabilitation kind of league. So yeah, the Milan derby, it's going to be an intriguing one. You know, a great landscape altering game in prospect.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the summer transfer business was the thing that caught my eye more than anything else, really, in the sense that Inter have had to, you know, sell a lot of players, and they've only spent half of what they've brought in, really. And I think Pavard will be a good signing for them at centre back. I think that's a really strong sign, and you can see that from the start they've had, that they're going to be strong. Milan, I think, have made some great signs. I think Noah Okafor is a good player that they've signed. Pulisic, obviously. Chukwueze is a good player. They've lost Tonali, which is kind of a bit of a talisman for them. But I think that they've got to turn it around, because this fixture's not been that pleasant for them, especially the last season. And even going back before then, they've not had a brilliant record over the last, what, 4, 5, 6 years. But as always, from any kind of derby game, there's always a bit of tension, there's always a bit of fire. And I'd be really pleased to see a good game, I think.
Yeah, I think it's got to be an intrigue. It might not necessarily be the greatest of spectacles. Hopefully it will be. But, you know, I think all of that intrigue, you know, as you say, you know, it's going to be a special game of football. Moving away, you know, for one last point of interest while we've been recording has been the, you know, belated resignation of Luis Rubiales. I mean, Rob, we were speaking about this last week. Then the question has to be, you know, why now and not a fortnight ago? You know?
Yeah, who knows? And the fact that apparently he's announced it with Piers Morgan or something like that.
Surreal to the very end.
Like we said last week, it's just crazy. And the fact it's taken this long is frankly quite disgusting, really. But he's done it, and they can move on and hopefully have a better culture in the Spanish FA.
I mean, Alex, the hope for better, but I don't know, Spain has a lot to do to clean up its act.
I think, yeah, Spain certainly does, but it appears we probably can't throw stones in our glass house. I think it's been a horrible summer. You know, you look at a wonderful Women's World Cup and then sort of tainted by what's going on around it. You know, likes of Antony and Greenwood at Manchester United. You know, we've had a couple of players still in the Premier League that are involved in these sort of situations, and it's clear that the federations and the clubs cannot handle this in a, you know, a kind of respectful and mature way. You see the way United have handled it, it's totally fumbled. The way that Spanish FA have done it, disgraceful. I don't know who needs to organise it, but somebody needs to be the adult in the room, because it's just bringing the game into disrepute, and it's causing so much pain for people involved that whether it needs to be UEFA or FIFA or the Premier League, kind of take an overarching view of what you do in these situations and have something constant. Because we've got some players, you know, there's a player playing for a leading Premier League team who's still involved in one of these cases. And there are others who have been removed from duty, and there needs to be some kind of strong and kind of regulated approach to it, because it's just clearly a massive, massive issue.
Rob, excellent point from Alex there. Glass houses as well. I think it's about changing conscience. You know, a greater conscience is needed, I think, for Spanish football. I'd like to think that, you know, from a British perspective, I think the audience, you know, we spoke last week of reading the room and, you know, how that Rubiales press conference, which just so incredulous, was that the audience wasn't even reading the room, you know, two-thirds of that audience. I think a lot of, you know, I think the audience, I think across the board is improving, but it still needs a lot of work on in some environments.
The longer this goes on, the worse it gets. The points that Alex makes really clearly there, it just shows that football is not dealing with it well. Nowhere, no one in football is coming out of this well. You know, there's even a comment about from Jill Scott about the Jordan Henderson situation where she said, "I wouldn't be welcome to play football there." And that, for me, kind of says it all with what's going on at the moment.
Brilliant points, brilliant points. Thank you so much, Alex. A wonderful debut.
No own goals yet.
No own goals, no. You've managed to get through without any own goals. Not even kind of like an erroneous back pass that has had the goalkeeper sweating. Thank you so much for your contributions to tonight, and we look forward to having you back on again in the weeks to come.
Great, been a pleasure.
Brilliant, thanks so much, Alex. And Rob, a wonderful second appearance. On for the hat-trick.
Yeah, definitely. It's nice to know that I'm not going to be a one-cap wonder like so many other players are in international football. So I've got my two caps, so let's see what number three brings.
Excellent stuff, excellent stuff. All that leaves me to do is to say thank you to the listener for joining us on another episode of Today's Football Times. Our weekly podcast is back up and running in true form as well. And we look forward to speaking to you again a week from now. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.